Fada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you don't want to miss it. To snag your copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into The Listening Room with host Timothy P. every other Thursday at 3 in the morning for a genre-bending 2.5-hour show where you never know what you might hear next, but you will be sure to be engaged and entertained.
Peace, power, and purpose to our Hard Knock family. This is Kalonji Changa. Honored to be sitting in the captain's chair today for our brother, Davey D. You're locked into Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Radio Network, the home of revolutionary hip-hop, community-led journalism, and the raw truth the mainstream refuses to touch. Holding it down on production, keeping the engine running smooth and the level sharp, we have the sister, Anita Johnson, riding shotgun. Today, we're taking a hard look at the state of the truce. As we enter the second week of January 2026, the world is hearing headlines about a ceasefire and a new board of peace. Yet, the smoke hasn't cleared. For our people in Gaza, ceasefire hasn't meant safety. It has meant a dangerous new phase of occupation and daily strikes. To help us navigate, we're bringing in a voice from the front lines of the Bay Area organizing. Our guest tonight is Samer Arabi, a member of the Arab Resource and Organization Center, AROC, an expert in the political economy of ceasefires. Samer isn't just an analyst, he's an organizer who has briefed the UN Security Council and worked directly in conflict zones. He joins us on behalf of AROC, a grassroots powerhouse dedicated to empowering the Arab community and organizing for justice and self-determination for all. Through leadership development and fierce political education, AROC builds community power in the Bay Area, proving that the struggle for a free Palestine is a long struggle. Samer, it's an honor to have you back on Hard Knock. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. It's really lovely to be here. Appreciate you inviting me.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. Who else do we have on that could be as sharp as Samer? You know what I mean? We had to invite you on.
I appreciate that.
Definitely, definitely glad to see you. I want to start off about the myth of the ceasefire. We're seeing reports today of drone strikes in the Morag corridor, despite the October 10th agreement. From AROC's perspective, is this a ceasefire in anything but name?
No. I mean, as we've seen with every past ceasefire that Israel has ostensibly signed, right? The idea here is when Israel signs a ceasefire, the other people cease and Israel fires, right? It's been that way in Lebanon. It's that way right now in Gaza. There hasn't been a week that's gone by since the ceasefire was signed that Israel hasn't massacred some number of civilians. And that number is actually going up, not down. So things are not looking great for sure.
Recent reports highlight Israel's creation of a yellow line buffer zone. How is this new boundary being used to justify ongoing strikes against civilians who approach it?
Yeah, the yellow line is a nightmare in almost countless ways. There's you know, maybe three or four main things that I think folks really need to understand to think about how Israel deploys systems like this to justify killing, but also land grabs and like ongoing settler colonialism, which, you know, is a project that hasn't stopped since Israel's founding. The first is the really easy one, which is just, you know, the yellow line, which, you know, now is marked by a series of yellow bricks. There used to be nothing at all. People just had to somehow intuit the line at which the Israeli forces had withdrawn to as per the ceasefire agreement. Now there's a line that sort of cuts, you know, you can sort of imagine like a reverse C shape inside Gaza, where Israelis continue to control the north, the south, and the east, basically cutting off the entire boundary of Gaza, where they continue to control everything. And there are, for all intents and purposes, no Palestinians in that area because they've all been pushed into this little small enclave in the middle. That yellow zone that Israel controls, which is over half the territory of Gaza, incidentally, is a, you know, no man's land where if a Palestinian somehow, you know, deigns to set foot outside of this prescribed area where they're supposed to be in and they step into that yellow zone, Israel feels that it has every right to kill that person. And that's what they've been doing. That in and of itself is bad enough, right? And then on top of that, what we've learned over the last few weeks is that that yellow line is actually not a fixed line. In fact, it is a static one. And there is now video footage of Israeli soldiers moving those yellow bricks further and further west, basically literally stealing additional land. And so not only are Palestinians expected to know where this line is, the line is moving towards them semi-regularly. So once again, as they were doing in Syria last year, as they're doing in Lebanon right now, and now as they're doing in Gaza, they're just steadily encroaching on land, right? I was going to say land that isn't theirs, but no land is theirs. More land that isn't theirs, I guess, and just taking it for themselves. So that's the second layer of this that I think is really troubling and something we need to sort of reckon with. And of course, they're doing it with total impunity and support by the United States. No one has done anything to stop them or the many other ways they have failed to abide by the ceasefire that they signed, right? Which, again, also called for the increase in humanitarian aid to levels that they haven't yet committed to. The allowance of semi-permanent structures to withstand the weather, which they are not letting in at all, which is why Palestinians are literally drowning to death in their tents right now. So in addition to all of that, there's this sort of expectation, you know, that Israel is supposed to hold this line, and they're not doing that either, and they're facing no repercussions for it. So unsurprisingly, that line continues to move. It's a really key piece that I think folks need to focus on in terms of where to put pressure on the United States to put pressure on Israel. But there's a third piece here, and I think the third piece might be the most insidious of the three, which is that, again, using this sort of very tried and true Israeli playbook, you're seeing the sort of partition and division and development and underdevelopment that characterized the Israeli state since its beginning. And so what we're hearing from U.S. administration officials, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen with this board of peace that's coming in, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But there are, you know, there are indications from government sources that Reconstruction aid is only going into the so-called yellow zone. So it's possible that we end up in a situation where all of these billions of dollars of Reconstruction assistance, to the extent that they ever actually materialize, are only going to go to the area that, one, Israel completely controls, and two, has no Palestinians in it, right? They've been completely cleansed out of that area. And so, you know, we could see a situation where all of the, you know, 2 million, 1 point whatever remaining Palestinians who have survived this genocide in Gaza are now, you know, an area that was before already one of the densest places on earth in terms of population, now in an area half that size, with absolutely no reconstruction possibility, if no aid and no concrete, no structures, no shelters, no metal is getting in. At the same time, that, you know, that money and that reconstruction assistance goes to the place where Israel is rebuilding in Gaza. And then, you know, this idea of Israelis settling the Gaza Strip, it feels more likely than ever.
You mentioned the U.S. and you mentioned the Board of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't even sound right coming out my mouth. There's a lot of talk about a Board of Peace overseen by the U.S., by the United States administration. What does this board actually mean for Palestinian sovereignty, or is it just another layer of external control?
I think we all know the answer to that. I had an interview earlier today where I referred to it as the board of everyone takes a piece, right? Which is like, you know, I mean, we don't know, right? I mean, the honest answer here is that the Board of Peace doesn't actually have a mandate, right? It's not like it has a charter. It doesn't have a clear delineation of authorities. There's no constitution under which it's supposed to be functioning. It's a pure, like almost, you know, like almost retro, like this sort of anachronistic colonial governance body, right? It's a bunch of Europeans and then a few token other people from other countries who are tasked with more or less unlimited power, because any power that isn't specifically prescribed, right? Anything that isn't anything they're not prohibited from doing, they're going to do, obviously. And right now the Board of Peace is not in fact prohibited from doing anything, right? Because there is no charter. There's no document that outlines its capabilities and its functions. So in effect, it's a group of people headed by Donald Trump, including Tony Blair, a person who famously has really done wonders for the Middle East generally, just, you know, like a war criminal in its most distilled element. And then a group of other people, you know, we're hearing rumors here and there about who else is joining this Board of Peace, but we don't really know. And then what they will do is anybody's guess, right? They could have a very heavy hand in the governance of Gaza. They could effectively be doing nothing at all. They could, you know, they could be overseeing like the stripping out of Gaza's natural resources to enrich their own countries. They could be using reconstruction aid to support their own domestic industries, right? We like the range here is very wide, as was the range of a colonial exploitation that we saw. You know, we're not talking about like neo-colonialism. We're talking about the old school colonialism of like, you know, the 1800s, where, you know, Europeans will just come in and strip everything out. And I think that's a really, it's a very conceivable outcome here, depending on, you know, how these things sort of constitute and where it comes out of it. I think the Board of Peace is supposed to actually be announced next week, supposedly at Davos, which I think, again, is very telling. At this, like, you know, international forum, they're going to announce who's on the Board of Peace and maybe what that Board of Peace is actually supposed to be doing. But it certainly can't be anything good, right? Like, as a rule of thumb, you know, sending in a bunch of white Europeans to tell a country what they should and shouldn't be doing doesn't go well. I don't know that it's ever gone well, and there's no reason to think it's going to go well this time. Yeah,
right. Yeah, never. You know, I couldn't imagine it. I mean, it's just reminds me of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about who the founder was, and then you know, you're surprised when tyrants, you know, receive the Nobel Peace Prize. It's like, I guess you didn't know who Alfred Noble was. So I guess, you know, It really matters, right? You should be insulted to get the Nobel Peace Prize, to be quite honest.
That's exactly right. And this year was, you know, couldn't get any clearer than this year with Karina Machado. My goodness. But like that, I mean, we live under, you know, the sort of like liberal governance global infrastructure is specifically designed, right, to uphold the sort of existing status quo and you know, like white supremacy at this very high level. You know, one thing, you know, like the Nobel Prize is one, but another that I think a lot of folks don't know, the reason that the UN Charter mentions human rights, like the person who put the human rights language into the UN Charter was the president of apartheid South Africa. Right, like that's where that actually comes from. And so like, it should give you a sense of like when the West talks about human rights, what they actually mean, right? And again, we're seeing it right every day here in Gaza.
You're checking out Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Network. This is Kalonji Changa. I'm rapping with Samer Arabi, and he's speaking truth to power. And we're trying to figure it all out here. You know, Samer, I really want to go back to this whole ceasefire business, because you know that's been thrown around so much that some folks are beginning to believe the hype. I don't know where they live, what rock they live under, but you know, I want to ask. We've heard the term ceasefire used in mainstream headlines for months now, yet we're seeing reports of continued strikes in Khan Yunis and Gaza City. From AROC's perspective, what is the actual state of this "quote unquote" truce right now?
I mean, it's not one, right? Like to call this a ceasefire would be a farce, you know. And as I said, Israel has been killing people more or less every single day, and certainly every week since that ceasefire was signed. You know, we can't ignore the fact that the death toll has obviously gone down significantly since the ceasefire was signed, right? That's not nothing. You know, these are human lives that we're talking about, and you know, we were at a point where about 1,000 people were being killed every week. Before the so-called ceasefire was signed, and now it's, you know, less than 100 or so. That's a, you know, like every single Palestinian life is somebody's world, right? And I think we can't just take that for granted, that you know, people have the opportunity to live and rebuild and return to their homes in ways that they weren't before. But that's severely constrained and nowhere near the level that it's supposed to be, right? The fact that 100 people are being killed every week is still a horror show, right? Like, you know, we're just so now inured to what we've been witnessing in this genocide for the past 2.5 years that feels like a reprieve, but it's totally unacceptable. And the fact that it's continuing in this way, you know, I think in many ways is it's dangerous in different ways than the hot war was, because as you said, you know, right before the ceasefire happened, you know, there's no question, right? Palestinians were suffering much more then than they are now, but they also had the world's attention, right? And they had the sort of like global solidarity that was coming alongside of that. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that when the ceasefire was signed was just weeks after what we started seeing from like global labor solidarity work, where we were seeing general strikes, you know, completely paralyzing total like countries, entire countries, including Italy. And at that point, right, this sort of fever pitch of global solidarity with Palestine was the moment where they're like, oh, okay, you know, like we got to turn people's attention somewhere else. And on some level, that tactic worked, right? Because Palestine doesn't get the same level of attention, support, and solidarity that it was getting 6 months ago. Not even close. And, you know, I think a lot of us are still holding Palestine very close to our hearts. It's hard not to when we continue to see that suffering. But most people aren't seeing it anymore, right? It's not getting front page news coverage. It's not in the sort of traditional press in the same kind of way. People are sort of able to talk about it as if it were a thing that had happened, as opposed to a thing that is continuing to happen, right? The genocide in Gaza is not over. It's nowhere near over. And in many ways, the genocide aspect of it is accelerating, right? We're seeing the Israeli government identify ways to ethnically cleanse the remaining Palestinians in Gaza, right? There's no clearer example of this, I think, than the fact that the southern border of Gaza, between Gaza and Egypt, which, you know, again, is not Israeli, right? Like it's a border between Palestine and Egypt. is only allowed to be opened one way, meaning that, you know, Palestinians are now allowed to leave Gaza to go to Egypt. But if they do, they are not allowed to return, right? There's no way back in. There is no border that is open into Gaza right now. And, you know, I think these conversations about trying to mass remove Palestinians from Gaza continues to be the case, where it seems like, you know, it's hard to know, but the Israeli recognition of Somaliland that happened last week seems in part at least motivated by the idea that Somaliland might take Palestinian refugees out of Gaza, willingly or unwillingly. And so in many ways, the genocide is at its most crucial junction. And this, more than any other moment, I think, is the moment where we really need to double down and make sure that, you know, this unimaginable crime of a generation can't continue to be perpetuated. And I think we need to build on the power that we've built, right? The reason that ceasefire was signed was due to overwhelming public global pressure. That was a win, right? It wasn't the win that we wanted it to be. It isn't, you know, the liberation of Palestine. It's not like a good ceasefire, but the fact that there was a ceasefire at all was a win. And I do think we need to acknowledge that. But we need to build on that win, right? It's not enough that we got that, as we can see with what's happening every week. Like, that ceasefire wasn't enough. But given how globally unpopular Israel is, given how toxic, like, any association with Israel is, even among the right, even among the authoritarian right, that really tells us something about where we can move in this moment. And, you know, I think how critical it is at this juncture that we do everything we possibly can to stop that genocide, not only for the people of Palestine, incidentally, although that should be enough, but also because we're also seeing the ripple effects of what that genocide in Gaza has done to the rest of the world, right? And the new norms and standards that it's setting for the ways that, you know, these imperial countries can manage in international affairs. Right? The road to Venezuela goes straight through Gaza, right? We can't understand what the Trump administration is doing in Venezuela without understanding the norms and precedents that were set in Gaza, right? Those things are directly linked to each other. And, you know, you don't have to look far in Minnesota right now to see scenes that look straight out of the West Bank, right? Like, these are tactics and training that came directly from the Israelis. So the lines here are very deep and very clear. And, you know, as we always say, like, you know, Palestine frees us, right? Like, making sure that we focus directly on this and this campaign and the freedom and liberation of Palestine, because it is the conduit through which we reach, like, freedom and liberation for all people, you know?
You know, you mentioned places like Venezuela. You mentioned what's going on over in Minnesota. And living in Atlanta, I can't help but think about GILE, the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, where the local police or state police here in the state of Georgia are actually trained. They actually go to Jerusalem every year for the past 30 years to receive training from the IDF. So, you know, when you talk about the connection, it's not a far-fetched situation. We had Cop City over here, and we know that Cop City, you can find ties to the School of Americas. And with the School of Americas, you can find, you know, ties to the assassination of the Haitian president, you know, recently. And, that's right. You know, what's going, of course, in Venezuela, et cetera, right? I wanna talk about, because, you know, you talked about, you know, we've been talking about the ceasefire. I want to go to international law and accountability. You've worked extensively in research and accountability. Why do you think the international community seemingly is unable or unwilling to enforce the terms of a ceasefire when violations are documented in real time?
Oof, that's a very good question. That's a really, really good question. And I think it's something that really surprised people, the extent to which the entire, you know, so-called international community has been totally incapable of doing anything, or maybe unwilling. You know, there's some, you know, where it is on that spectrum of unwilling to unable, I think it's not super clear. But I think a few things are very clear. You know, one, we live in an age where, you know, the U.S. is sort of this, like, dying global hegemon, you know, this global spanning empire that feels sort of teetering on its own implosion, but nevertheless maintains that hegemony, right? It is. The U.S. continues to be a global hegemon in a way that it can assert its power and influence across the world in a way that, unfortunately, particularly in places like Western Europe, everybody just sort of kowtows, right? Like everybody just follows along with US dictates. And the few countries that don't, Venezuela, Iran, right? We're seeing what's happening to those countries that don't follow in lockstep with US empire. So I think that's a really big part of it, that, you know, given the relationship between the United States and Israel and the strategic interest of US empire in keeping Israel strong, right? This isn't like the Israelis secretly manipulating the United States. No, it's, you know, Israel fulfills US colonial overseas ambitions in a really clear way. And given that, and given the value that the US places on having the sort of, you know, controlling force within the heart of the Arab world, it's not surprising, right? The US is exerting its influence this way, and in so doing, tearing down the entire global order that it itself built. That's the wildest part, right? That the so-called rules-based international order that the US likes to talk about a lot, which itself, by the way, was a thing that the US imposed on an existing system of international law, right? There used to be international law, and the US decided, that sounds too like objective and, you know, outside of our own capabilities. So we're going to change that to the rules-based international order, meaning our rules, our order, right? So the US sets the rules. And what we've learned in the last couple of years is actually, no, the US is perfectly happy to tear up all of those rules whenever it wants to. So now this US, you know, this rules-based international order is collapsing, or maybe has already collapsed. And we're seeing some of the consequences of that, right? Like what they were willing to let happen in Palestine has also sort of opened the floodgates for, you know, India and Pakistan attacking each other and, you know, like all these sort of new rivals, you know, Cambodia, Thailand stuff in ways that I really don't think we would have seen pre-Gaza. So watching the US exert its sort of global hegemony to give Israel that impunity, I think, is a really key piece of this. But I do think that there's a second and really important piece that folks need to wrestle with, and that I myself, I think, I'm really start trying to sort of wrap my head around. And that's, okay, you know, we're in this moment of collapsing US empire, but we're also in this moment of the collapsing world order, right? Like the systems on which the world is built seem to be crumbling under our feet. And I think everybody feels that, right? This sort of upsurge of authoritarianism, the sort of collapse of, you know, the so-called golden age of capitalism for all of its horrors. Like, you know, even in the few ways that it did work, those ways are now breaking down, right? There's this crisis of profitability. There's this, you know, everything is operating on a razor thin margin. You know, the states are basically all bankrupt while these like tiny group of companies are making an unimaginable amount of money. It's rendered states largely powerless, right? They're dependent on market conditions to such an extent that they're not able to exert anything, right? This is the same reason that, you know, Europe, for all of its, you know, pearl-clutching about what has happened, pearl-clutching isn't the right phrase because it is actually pretty intense, what's been happening in Ukraine, right? Like, you know, watching Europe freak out about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and then being able to do nothing about it. And not only to do nothing about it, but to continue to buy Russian oil while condemning Russia for invading Ukraine, right? They're in the situation where they have no power and they have no control. And so unsurprisingly, right, the UN, the, you know, like EU, these systems that were designed for a very specific set of conditions that no longer exist, but also were built in a, you know, were built to uphold a sort of colonial system that, you know, has not been violated in this particular case, makes it really hard to use those tools. Because they're not effective in this situation, right? Both for both of those reasons. And I think it raises a lot of really complicated questions about where we go from here, you know, because like we're not trying to go back to the status quo, right? The issue here isn't that the US broke the rules, right? The issue is that the rules were bogus to begin with. Where does that take us in terms of what kind of vision of a world are we trying to create, right? Like, where are we in this moment? And where do we go from here? And again, Palestine is this clarifying function, right? Like, what does that look like? And what are we trying to do beyond to stop the horror, right? Like, what are we trying to build? And I think that raises a lot of really interesting and really powerful questions that I think are going to be critical for us in this like time of uncertainty that we're coming into, where we can't take anything for granted anymore, you know?
Absolutely. is often talk about the domestic manifestation of global militarism. How does the continued bombing of Gaza connect back to the policies and funding we see coming out of the U.S. and specifically the Bay Area?
Yeah, it's a really good, it's a really, really good question. And you know, the boomerang effect is real, right? We see weapons and technologies designed here being tested out in Israel on Palestinians and then coming back here, right? You know, actually what we're seeing literally right now in the Bay Area, and I think a lot of folks might not even be aware of this, is the city is currently putting out tenders for contracts for video surveillance software to like blanket the city in like smart surveillance cameras, basically to like ID everybody all the time. And you know, you won't be surprised to hear that several of the like highest consideration bidders right now are Israeli tech companies who built that stuff to monitor Palestinians. And that technology of monitoring and surveillance for the use of state violence is coming back here, right? And we're already seeing it, right? What we saw in the sort of LA uprisings of last year was, you know, Waymos and like traffic light cameras being used to identify protesters, right? And this is the daily reality of Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. And it's becoming the daily reality of people here. We're seeing it in Minnesota now too, obviously. Particularly now, where they're doing these sort of like door-to-door raids, which, by the way, again, directly out of the IDF playbook in the way that they're doing those raids. So it's not surprising, right? But it is pretty horrifying the way that, you know, this is always the case, right? Like, and this is why I feel like, despite the fact that a lot of folks who are really focused on domestic issues don't tend to spend much time thinking about what's happening overseas, right? Like, oh, that's a problem, you know, that's a foreign relations problem. It's not like a national thing. But the reality of empire is everything that empire tries overseas will inevitably come back home, right? It's a tried and true fact of history. And we're seeing it now in the same way, like the destruction that we allowed to be wrought in Gaza is coming right back home. Right. And we see it in our everyday lives, and we're only seeing the beginning of it. It's going to get much worse.
The microcosm is a microcosm of the macrocosm.
Amen.
Especially in the police state. You know, it's what we expect. And they will remix whatever is necessary. Start off with the Gestapo and end up with ICE. Either way, yep. It's the same old two-step. You're checking out Hard Knock Radio. This is Kalonji Changa. Filling in for Davey D. We're on the Pacifica Radio Network. I got my man Samer in the building today, and he's probably going to get us both blackballed, but it's all good. We're going out together on this track. So we're talking about this quote-unquote ceasefire, which I would argue that it's somewhat of a joke to an extent. It's not very funny at that. But, you know, I want to tap into some of... you know, I want to know, because, you know, again, we're stuck in the whole ceasefire thing. I want to know, how is the fragility of this ceasefire impacting the broader movement for liberation across the Swana region from Yemen to Syria?
Ooh, what a very good question. And, you know, like everybody's attempt at sort of dignity, liberation and self-determination across that whole region right now is being stymied directly by Israel. Right, it's the Israeli occupation in Syria, which I saw firsthand last year. I managed to like pop over to Damascus and then like swung through the south of Syria to see it for myself. It's rough. And then like, you know, Israeli strikes in Yemen, right? The ongoing occupation and attacks in Lebanon. All these countries extremely fragile, right? Teetering on economic collapse. Only being further destabilized by, you know, the one continuing like warmongering aggressor in the region. And so I think it's a hard road ahead, right? For all of those people, it's going to take a lot of determination, and they're going to have to get through a lot of suffering, I'm sorry to say, for them to come out on the other side of this with something that even remotely resembles, you know, a functioning state that gives people, a basic level of like respect, dignity, and autonomy. But it's compounded again by you know, two additional things: U.S. meddling, of course, as always, but also that they have to operate within this global system, right? And this global system that, again, is sort of collapsing. So Syria right now is hyper-dependent on international assistance, and that largely means Western assistance and also Gulf assistance, which in many ways is the same thing as Western assistance, since their interests are basically, you know, the Venn diagram of their interests is just a circle. So you are seeing a series of extremely unpopular positions and decisions being made by the new Syrian government in a really desperate attempt to get access to badly, badly needed reconstruction funds. Among those is, you know, the Israelis having free use of Syrian airspace, which they not only use to sort of, you know, the bombings of Iran that happened last year, but also sometimes they bomb Syria with the airspace that Syria is giving them. So, you know, it's hard to imagine a worse scenario for people than that, right? Really stuck in a situation where, you know, part of your country is occupied, the rest of it has no total sovereignty, right? There is no functioning security apparatus. Turkey also incidentally occupying a large chunk of Syria in the north that I also got to see. And then, you know, we're seeing similar sort of power rivalries play out in Yemen, where, you know, the Israelis aren't on the ground. Well, I mean, sure, Mossad is on the ground, but the Israeli military hasn't like permanently set up on the ground. Instead, it's the Saudis and the Emiratis, who themselves seem to be fighting, which, you know, we don't have to get like too deep into the weeds here, but like, it's messy, you know, the enemies of the enemies of Israel are fighting each other in a really weird way that also relates back to the Somaliland, this like Somaliland curveball that we saw last week with the recognition of Somaliland by Israel. So the whole region, I think, is really in a moment of great flux. And I think, as we saw with the Arab Spring, that can produce some pretty horrible outcomes. But also it opens up the span of possibility, right? Like, we don't know. We have no idea what that region is going to look like 10 to 15 years from now. And that means there's possibility, right? And with that possibility, I think really comes some hope that something outside of, you know, these dictatorial governments that are totally beholden to the West can be replaced by something that actually, you know, is built by people and is designed for people. But yeah, as in the United States, right? The paths now suddenly open to us are much broader than they've been in a long time, and that's both terrifying and really hopeful. You know, so it'll depend on a lot of things, including how we react to these moments.
Terrifying and hopeful is always a strange place to be, right?
Yep.
I want to. Hamas recently announced it would dissolve its government for technocratic committee. How does the threat of continued bombing affect the ability of any Palestinian body to actually govern?
Yeah, I mean, govern, like, what does governing even mean in a context like this, right? So, you know, Hamas has been trying to let go of its governance capabilities in Gaza for years, right? Well before this recent accelerated Israeli genocide. And has been trying to form a unity government for, you know, well over a decade, if not longer. So the idea of Hamas giving up its governance functions isn't something inherently new, but I think obviously, you know, this is happening in the context of this Board of Peace ceasefire part two stuff, whatever. It's not a really realistic outcome in this particular moment, right? And what they, as I understand their statement, they were just like, okay, you know, like when there's Palestinian government, like when there's new Palestinian governance, we'll step aside. But there's no conception of like when that will actually be, right? There's no time. There's no like expected transition of authority and power like that. None of that exists. And again, none of this has been written out on paper anywhere. Right. But what's happening, what seems to be happening, at least, is that Trump is really keen to get the so-called ceasefire to stage two, despite the fact that, as we've already discussed, stage one has been a total failure. Right. And none of the things that were supposed to be implemented in stage one, other than the Palestinian militant factions have stopped firing. That has happened. But other than that, basically nothing has happened on the, you know, in terms of step one of the ceasefire. Nevertheless, Trump is very keen for step two to start. And step two has, you know, the establishment of this board of peace, right? Which, again, we're going to hear about next week. And then under the board of peace is a Palestinian, you know, quote unquote, technocratic government. And, you know, folks probably are well aware that technocratic is this like weasel word for often the worst people in the world. But so, you know, who constitutes that technocratic government? Nobody knows, right? The Israelis will not allow anyone from Hamas, but also no one from Hamas's main political opponents, the Palestinian Authority, the like Fatah people, also not allowed to be part of that governance body. They all have to be non-political, whatever that means. And again, that's like not a real thing. Right. So who will constitute this new governing authority? Nobody knows. When will it actually take its new position? Nobody knows. And then critically, most importantly of all, frankly, what governing authority will that body actually have? Again, technically nobody knows, but we probably know because, again, they work under the Board of Peace. And so whatever the Board of Peace deigns to, you know, devolve down to like the, you know, local administrative level is what that governing authority will be allowed to do. And at any point, the Board of Peace can take that authority back. It is pure, unadulterated colonialism. And so we don't put much stock in the governance capability of the like the colonially appointed governing body. So I don't have high hopes for whatever that governing body will look like. They clearly have no real mandate to govern, and there's clearly no desire for real Palestinian governance, which, you know, obviously the U.S. is not interested in Palestinian liberation, nor is, you know, Western Europe or the other powers that be. So this is a thing where, you know, as we know, right, like dignity and liberation are never going to be handed to you. That's just not the way the world works, right? It is a continuing struggle. And it will continue to be a struggle for Palestinians to really stand up and, you know, demand and achieve their own self-determination.
Right. Again, we're checking out Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Radio Network. This is Kalonji Changa, and we are here with Samer Arabi. We're talking about the quote-unquote ceasefire, amongst other things. And you know, we appreciate you tuning in. We want to talk about the humanitarian paradox, Samer. We have United Nations Relief and Works Agency with Palestine refugees in the Near East. Staff are still being blocked and killed despite the truce. Why has the ceasefire failed to open the floodgates for the massive amount of aid sitting at the borders?
The short answer to that is that's how Israel designed it. Israel has no desire to see Palestinians healthy and functioning on Palestinian land. This is part of the genocide. It's actually a key piece of the genocide to make the situation in the Gaza Strip unlivable. And so despite the fact that there's more than enough aid right across the border, that aid continues to not be allowed to get in. And to the extent that aid does get in, it's aid for basic daily sustenance. Right, so you're getting food and water, and those things are not coming at anywhere near the levels they need to be coming. But at least some of it is coming. What's not coming at all is what, you know, we call stabilization assistance, which is generally supposed to be one step up from direct humanitarian assistance, which is things like shelter, electricity, right, functioning infrastructure, like rebuilt roads, you know, and none of that is happening. And again, this feels very deliberate and very purposive. And one thing that we saw just, you know, these past couple of weeks directly related to this was Israel barring 60 humanitarian and aid organizations from operating, including Doctors Without Borders, the first time in human history that any country has blocked Doctors Without Borders from operating in their country. No one has ever had the gall to do that before. You know, the Israelis, in a, you know, again, very typical fashion, basically had asked all of these organizations to provide a full list of the names and identities of every single Palestinian that works for them. And as we've seen over the past 2.5 years, Israel deliberately targets and assassinates Palestinian aid workers. And so, you know, those organizations were like, in good conscience, we can't give you that information because you're going to use it to kill these people, as we've seen you do. And so they've been blocked from operating, technically not blocked from operating in Gaza, blocked from operating in Israel, which, you know, if you can't get into Israel, you can't get into Gaza. There's no other way in, as we've discussed, right? So not only does it really kneecap the ability of these organizations to get in and distribute the aid that should be going in, which again is not going in at the levels it's supposed to be, but more importantly, it prohibits them from doing the work that they need to do on the ground. And again, you talk about an organization like Doctors Without Borders, it's not about them bringing in supplies, right? It's that they need, like, that medical personnel needs to be on the ground to provide medical care, and that medical care is critical to ensuring human survival. And the fact that they're cutting that off specifically, I think, is very, very telling. As we've seen over the last 2.5 years of this genocide, targeting health infrastructure and the ability for people in Gaza to get any sort of health care has been a key aspect of the overall Israeli strategy of ethnic cleansing. And so I think we need to understand what's happening with the humanitarian crisis directly in that context.
To sit and watch the genocide in Palestine, genocide of Palestinians, the genocide taking place in the Sudan, the U.S. government bum-rushing Venezuela and just snatching the president and his wife out of their home and bringing them to New York City of all places, you know, by force, and you know, the assault on Iran, you know, it's just so much going on right now. ICE here in the United States, you know, domestically, you know, and we can go on and on and on. We can literally would be here for days just talking about, you know, the atrocities committed by Israel and the U.S. without even going into France and some of the other players, right? AROC has been vocal about domestic militarism. How do the weapons being used in these ceasefire violations today connect back to the tech and defense contracts right here in our backyard?
Oh, the through line couldn't be clearer. And this is in so many ways a tech-enabled genocide. And again, this is sort of this like boomerang effect in, you know, in all of its manifestations, right? The targeting systems that Israel uses are from AI, you know, like AI cloud, whatever stuff being sold to them by Google and Microsoft and Amazon. And those organizations, you know, not only have all more or less in the last year or so removed any previous restrictions that they had about using AI for military stuff, but have really gone whole hog, right, in terms of supplying and providing military assistance with that stuff, which is now being marketed to the Defense Department to use here. And again, the exact same scenario that we were talking about earlier, this has been so, you know, quote unquote, battle tested, right? Like they've seen it being used to massacre civilians in Gaza. And of course, the United States wants to use it to massacre people here and abroad. And, you know, it, in the same way that we had discussed how all of these different pieces are connected, right? You're seeing, one, the way that these tech companies are turning on their own workers, right? The number of people who are being fired for, you know, trying to protest these company policies, for example. But also, you know, the donations that are going to hard right politicians from those tech companies, right? The sort of standing in lockstep with the Trump administration, using the surveillance and AI technology for ICE, and like monitoring our phone calls. You know, that ICE now has access to tools that allow them to draw an area on a city map, and it will show you every single person in that city map area that they've drawn, their entire like past movements for the past, like, I don't know, however many weeks, based on their telephone data. And they can do this without a warrant because they're just buying that information directly from the tech companies. And so, like, if an ICE agent is interested in you, by the way, he can know within like minutes, you know, like everybody you've called, everywhere you've been, like where you shop, where you sleep, where you work, where you eat, And that's a direct consequence of some of these like engagements with military contractors in the ways that, you know, they've been using this to surveil the population in Gaza too. So we're living in a really dystopian moment, largely created by the dystopias that we've created overseas, right? This is really chickens coming home to roost. And you know, it's a horror that allows us to sort of link some of these struggles together. You know, like one thing I was always really struck by back when, you know, I met Cori, I was lucky enough to meet Cori Bush back when she was running for re-election before, you know, AIPAC forced her out of her seat. And one of the things she talked about during the St. Louis uprisings was how in the early days of the St. Louis uprisings, it was Palestinians who were living in St. Louis who were like, we've seen this playbook before. Like, we know the tactics the police are going to use on you. Here's how to defend yourselves. Here's how to like organize. Here's how to, you know, like protect yourself from tear gas. Here's how to like avoid government surveillance. This is not new, right? It's just new for certain people. And I think that that's, you know, it's scary, but it also speaks to what global solidarity can do, right? When we come together in these moments. And I think, you know, it's obviously also happening right now in Minnesota. So yeah, a really difficult moment of reckoning.
No doubt, no doubt. You mentioned about the whole perimeter where ICE can know where you are, so on and so forth. It's called geofencing, which is reverse location search. Yeah, so for the listeners, it's a software-based technique that creates a virtual perimeter around a specific geographic area. And it's used by law enforcement to, you know, as Samer mentioned, to data source, get your location history, search through your phones and whatnot. And you used to have a warrant from companies like Google and Apple, so on and so forth. But now, as Samer mentioned, it's up for grabs. And they also have, what do you call it, Stingray, where they have the whole cell site stimulators, where they actually, you can be at a protest and, you know, they have this device that's sort of like a suitcase, and it tricks the cell phones into believing that it's a cell phone tower. And so all of your information, everyone that's in that area, their information is fed through this particular system. So when we talk about surveillance and we talk about Israel and Gaza and you know, what's going on in Minnesota and, you know, just home and abroad, tech is definitely, you know, it's tech warfare to the fullest right now. You know, and the cameras, just talking about the cameras and everything, we're in Atlanta and they have 20,000 something cameras across the city. And the wildest thing about it is, you know, all the true crimes, you know, are not accounted for. No one's getting, you know, the murders, the armed robberies, the carjackings, you know, the beat goes on, you know, yeah. But they have these cameras. Yeah. I don't know what's going on, but, yeah. You know, I want to, before we exit, I want to talk about resilience and the Samud. Am I saying that correct?
Yeah, Samud.
Okay. We see Palestinians in Gaza returning to rubble to plant gardens and hold protests. How is the concept of the Samud shifting now that the war is officially, quote unquote, paused, but the killing continues?
Oof. Yeah, that's a very good question. It takes a different type of Samud, I think, for this moment. And I think it's one that we can all learn something from, right? Like moving from a moment where the only concern was surviving, right? Like literally just escaping the bombs, which were relentless and omnipresent. And now to be in a situation where there's at least some, you know, restoration and rebuilding, and the number of, you know, Palestinians I've seen rebuilding their homes with their own bare hands in this moment, right? Moving into these blown out buildings and refusing to leave, really tells us something about the resilience of a people who, you know, who have been pushed to the brink of extinction for 70 plus years now, right? And these last 2.5 years in particular, but, you know, remember that the folks in Gaza are all people who were mostly people who were displaced previously, you know, displaced back in 1948 and then displaced again in 1953 and then displaced again in 67 and then displaced again in 73. that is placed again, you know, in the like the Sharon attacks on Gaza. And then just in these past 2.5 years, most of them, you know, have moved 5 or 6 times. And to go through all of that and still, you know, consider yourself a Gazan, to consider yourself a Palestinian, to refuse to be like a pawn in these imperial games, it's really a remarkable act of steadfastness and courage and commitment that I think all of us can really learn a lot from, you know. And like this moment asks a lot of all of us, and I think sometimes it's really easy to feel overwhelmed in moments like this when you're up against, you know, titans. You know, here you are, you know, David with your slingshot, and it can feel overwhelming and it can feel disempowering, but it's really valuable to remember in moments like that, that with courage and with vision and with steadfastness, we really can't be beaten. We can't be beaten. The most powerful forces on earth, concentrated and unrelenting in their violence and aggression, in their hatred and their racism, and they still can't beat us. You know, here we are, and we continue to be here, and we will continue to be here. And I think that's as true for, you know, the like struggle for Black liberation, the struggle for Palestinian dignity, the struggle for like queer and trans folks. It's it's the same struggle manifesting in very different ways, but there's really something to be said about all of us working together to build a better world out of the ashes of this one.
With that being said, like David with his slingshot, Hard Knock Radio will continue to rock you. We are here with Samer Arabi. We want to thank Samer for joining us here today. Again, this is Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Radio Network.
A little bit of both.
And we will continue to fight for liberation. We continue to give you what you need. I'm Kalonji Changa, filling in for DVD. Until next time, we say FTP, Free the Palestinians. We're out.
Thank you.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
When I'm feeling a little bit low, I listen to my radio. 90.7 on the FM dial. It's always sure to make me smile. KBOO. Boo! This is Michelle Shock saying howdy.
This is Bird Note. The call of the common loon is a symbol of the far north. Hear a loon in a movie, and there's a good chance the scene isn't far from the Arctic Circle. But common loons once nested as far south as southern New England, Ohio, Iowa, and California. Human activity and changes to the landscape in these more populated areas has made it harder for loons to persist. There have been encouraging signs in recent years that common loons could make a comeback in the southern parts of their range. Biologists have reintroduced loons to carefully chosen lakes in New England. And in the Pacific Northwest, scattered breeding populations remain. They seem to like decent-sized lakes with deep coves, good water quality, and plenty of fish. You can help welcome loons back to the places they once lived by enjoying them from a respectful distance, limiting the amount of boating on lakes where they're found, avoiding lead fishing gear, collecting garbage that loons could get tangled in, and preserving vegetation along the shoreline. Learn more about common loon conservation at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is in memory of Miriam Williams of Seattle, whose sense of humor, love of birds, and support of Bird Note made the world brighter. Thank you.
listening to Spill
on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week,